and looked back with yearning to the efficient government of Henry I, but a greater than he was at hand. In 1147, Robert of Gloucester died, and the leadership of Maud's party devolved upon her son. Henry Plantagenet was born to empire. His grandfather, Fulk, had made the Angevin lands, Anjou, Touraine, and Maine, a principality unsurpassed in France, and in resources more than the equal of Normandy. Fulk died in 1143, King of Jerusalem, leaving two sons to succeed him on that precarious throne, and a third, Geoffrey, as heir to his French dominions. Geoffrey's marriage with Maud had united the Norman and Angevin lands, and the child of this marriage was from his birth in 1133 recognized as the master of many peoples. To contemporaries, he was best known as Henry Fitz-Empress, but he carried into English history the emblem of his house, the broom, the Plantagenesta, which later generations were to make the name of this great dynasty, the Plantagenets. He embodied all their ability, all their energy, and not a little of that passionate, ruthless ferocity which, it was whispered, came to the House of Anjou from no mortal source, but from a union with Satan himself. When scarcely 15 in 1147, Henry had actively championed his claim to the English throne on English soil. His small band of followers was then defeated by Stephen's forces, and he took refuge in Normandy. The Empress Maud gave up her slender hopes of success in the following year and joined her son in the duchy. 19 years of life remained before her, but she never set foot in England again. Works of piety, natural to the times, filled many of her days. But in the years that followed Henry's triumph, she played an important political part as regent in Normandy and in his hereditary Angevin dominions. During her interventions in England in quest of the crown, the charge of arrogance was often levelled against her. But in her older age, she proved a sagacious counsellor to her son. Henry was involved in a further attempt against England in 1149, but the campaign projected on his behalf by the King of Scots and the Earl of Chester came to nothing. For a few years of comparative peace, King Stephen was left in uneasy possession. In the meantime, Henry was invested by his parents in 1150 as Duke of Normandy. The next year, his father's death made him also Count of Anjou, Touraine, and Maine. In his high feudal capacity, Henry repaired to Paris to render homage to his lord, the King of France, of which country he already possessed, by the accepted law of the age, a large part. Louis VII was a French Edward the Confessor. He practiced with faithful simplicity the law of Christ. All his days were spent in devotion, and his nights in vigil or penance. When he left his own chapel, he would delay the whole court by waiting till the humblest person present had preceded him. These pious and exemplary habits did not endear him to his queen. Eleanor of Aquitaine was in her own right a reigning princess, with the warmth of the south in her veins. She had already complained that she had married a monk and not a king, when this square-shouldered, ruddy youth, with his countenance of fire, sprightly talk, and overflowing energy, suddenly presented himself before her husband as his most splendid vassal. Eleanor did not waste words in coming to a decision. The papacy bowed to strong will in the high feudal chiefs, and Eleanor obtained a divorce from Louis VII in 1152 on the nominal grounds of consanguinity. But what staggered the French court and opened the eyes of its prayerful king was the sudden marriage of Eleanor to Henry 2 months later. Thus, half of France passed out of royal control into the hands of Henry. Rarely have passion and policy flowed so buoyantly together. The marriage was one of the most brilliant political strokes of the age. Henry afterwards admitted his designs and accepted the admiration of Europe for their audacity. He was 19, and she was probably 30, and uniting their immense domains, they made common cause against all comers. To Louis VII were vouchsafed the consolations of the spirit, but even these were jarred upon by the problems of government. War in all quarters lay before the royal pair. The joining to Normandy and Anjou of Poitou, Saintonge, Périgord, the Limousin, the Angoumois and Gascony, with claims of suzerainty over Auvergne and Toulouse, fascinated and convulsed the feudal Christian world. Everywhere men shook their heads over this concentration of power, this spectacle of so many races and states, sundered from each other by long feuds or divergent interests, now suddenly flung together by the hot blood of a love intrigue. From all sides, the potentates confronted the upstart. The King of France, who certainly had every conceivable cause of complaint, King Stephen of England, who disputed Henry's title to the Norman duchy, though without force to intervene across the Channel, the Count of Champagne, the Count of Perche, and Henry's own brother Geoffrey, all spontaneously, and with good reason, fell upon him. A month after the marriage, these foes converged upon Normandy. But the youthful Duke Henry beat them back, ruptured and broken. The Norman army proved once again its fighting quality. Before he was 20, Henry had cleared Normandy of rebels and pacified Anjou. He turned forthwith to England. It was a valiant figure that landed in January 1153, and from all over England, distracted by civil wars, hearts and eyes turned towards him. Merlin had prophesied a deliverer. Had he not in his veins blood that ran back to William the Conqueror, and beyond him, through his grandmother Matilda, wife of Henry I, to Cedric and the long-vanished Anglo-Saxon line? A wild surge of hope greeted him from the tormented islanders, and when he knelt after his landing in the first church he found, to pray for a space in the manner of soldiers, the priest pronounced the wish of the nation in the words, "Behold, there cometh the Lord, the ruler, and the kingdom is in his hand." There followed battles. Malmesbury, where the sleet, especially directed by Almighty God, beat upon the faces of his foes. Wallingford, where King Stephen, by divine interposition, fell three times from his horse before going into action. Glamour, terror, success attended this youthful, puissant warrior, who had not only his sword but his title deeds. The baronage, on the other hand, saw their interests favoured by a stalemate. They wanted neither a victorious Stephen nor a triumphant Henry. The weaker the king, the stronger the nobles. A treaty was concluded at Winchester in 1153, whereby Stephen made Henry his adopted son and his appointed heir. "In the business of the kingdom," promised Stephen, "I will work by the counsel of the Duke. But in the whole realm of England, as well in the Duke's part as my own, I will exercise royal justice." On this Henry did homage, and made all the formal submissions. And when a year later Stephen died, he was acclaimed and crowned King of England, with more general hope and rejoicing than had ever uplifted any monarch in England since the days of Alfred the Great. Chapter 4. Henry Plantagenet. The accession of Henry II began one of the most pregnant and decisive reigns in English history. The new sovereign ruled an empire, and, as his subjects boasted, his warrant ran from the Arctic Ocean to the Pyrenees. England to him was but one, the most solid, though perhaps the least attractive, of his provinces. But he gave to England that effectual element of external control which, as in the days of William of Orange, was indispensable to the growth of national unity. He was accepted by English and Norman as the ruler of both races and of the whole country. The memories of Hastings were confounded in his person, and after the hideous anarchy of civil war between robber barons, all due attention was paid to his commands. Thus, though a Frenchman, with foreign speech and foreign modes, he shaped our country in a fashion of which the outline remains to the present day. After 100 years of being the encampment of an invading army and the battleground of its quarrelsome officers and their descendants, England became finally and for all time a coherent kingdom based upon Christianity and upon that Latin civilization which recalled the message of ancient Rome. Henry Plantagenet first brought England, Scotland, and Ireland into a certain common relationship, He re-established the system of royal government which his grandfather, Henry I, had prematurely erected. He relaid the foundations of a central power, based upon the exchequer and the judiciary, which was ultimately to supersede the feudal system of William the Conqueror. The king gathered up and cherished the Anglo-Saxon tradition of self-government under royal command in shire and borough. He developed and made permanent assizes, as they survive today. It is to him we owe the enduring fact that the English-speaking race all over the world is governed by the English common law rather than by the Roman. By his Constitutions of Clarendon, he sought to fix the relationship of church and state and to force the church in its temporal character to submit itself to the life and law of the nation. In this endeavour he had, after a deadly struggle, to retreat, and it was left to Henry VIII, though centuries later, to avenge his predecessor by destroying the shrine of St. Thomas at Canterbury. A vivid picture is painted of this gifted and, for a while, enviable man. Square, thick-set, bull-necked, with powerful arms and coarse, rough hands. His legs bandy from endless riding. A large, round head and closely cropped red hair. A freckled face. A voice harsh and cracked. Intense love of the chase. Other loves, which the church deplored and Queen Eleanor resented. Frugality in food and dress. Days entirely concerned with public business. Travel unceasing. Moods various. It was said that he was always gentle and calm in times of urgent peril, but became bad-tempered and capricious when the pressure relaxed. He was more tender to dead soldiers than to the living, and found far more sorrow in the loss of those who were slain than comfort in the love of those who remained. He journeyed hot-foot around his many dominions, arriving unexpectedly in England when he was thought to be in the south of France. He carried with him, in his tours of each province, wains loaded with ponderous rolls, which represented the office files of his day. His court and train gasped and panted behind him. Sometimes, when he had appointed an early start, he was sleeping till noon, with all the wagons and pack-horses awaiting him fully laden. Sometimes he would be off hours before the time he'd fixed, leaving everyone to catch up as best they could. Everything was stirred and moulded by him in England, as also in his other much greater estates, which he patrolled with tireless attention. But this 12th-century monarch, with his lusts and sports, his hates and his schemes, was no materialist. He was the Lord's anointed. He commanded, with the Archbishop of Canterbury, those two strong steers that drew the plough of England, the whole allegiance of his subjects. The offices of religion, the fear of eternal damnation, the hope of even greater realms beyond the grave, accompanied him from hour to hour. At times he was smitten with remorse and engulfed in repentance. He drew all possible delights and satisfactions from this world and the next. He's portrayed to us in convulsions both of spiritual exaltation and abasement. This was no secluded monarch. The kings of those days were as accessible to all classes as a modern president of the United States. People broke in upon him at all hours with business, with tidings, with gossip, with visions, with complaints. Talk rang high in the king's presence and to his majesty's face among the nobles and courtiers, and the jester, invaluable monitor, castigated all impartially with unstinted license. Few mortals have led so full a life as Henry II, or have drunk so deeply of the cups of triumph and sorrow. In later life, he fell out with Eleanor. When she was over 50, and he but 42, he's said to have fallen in love with Fair Rosamond, a damsel of high degree and transcendent beauty, and generations have enjoyed the romantic tragedy of Queen Eleanor penetrating the protecting maze at Woodstock by the clue of a silken thread, and offering her hapless supplanter the hard choice between the dagger and the poisoned cup. Tiresome investigators have undermined this excellent tale, but it certainly should find its place in any history worthy of the name. Such was the man who succeeded to the troubled and divided inheritance of Stephen. Already before his accession to the English throne, Henry had fought the first of his many wars to defend his continental inheritance. Ever since the emergence of the strong Norman power in northwest France 100 years before, the French monarchy had struggled ceaselessly against the encroachments of great dukedoms and countships upon the central government. The dukes of Normandy, of Aquitaine, and of Brittany, the counts of Anjou, Toulouse, Flanders, and Boulogne, although in form and law vassals of the French crown, together with a host of other feudal tenants-in-chief, aspired to independent sovereignty, and in the eclipse of the monarchy seemed at times near to achieving their ambition. The Battle of Hastings had made the greatest French subject, the Duke of Normandy, also King of England. But Henry II's accession to the island throne in 1154 threatened France with far graver dangers. Hitherto, there'd always been political relief in playing off overmighty subjects one against another. The struggle between Anjou and Normandy in the 11th century had rejoiced the French king, who saw two of his chief enemies at grips. But when in 1 hour Henry II was King of England, Duke of Normandy, Lord of Aquitaine, Brittany, Poitou, Anjou, Maine, and Guienne, ruler from the Somme to the Pyrenees of more than half of France, all balance of power among the feudal lords was destroyed. Louis VII found instead of a dozen principalities, divided and jealous, one single imperial power, whose resources far surpassed his own. He was scarcely the man to face such a combination. He'd already suffered the irreparable misfortune of Eleanor's divorce and of her joining forces and blood with his rival. By him, she bore sons. By Louis, only daughters. Still, some advantages remained to the French king. He managed to hold out for his lifetime against the Plantagenets, and after nearly 4 centuries of struggle and devastation, the final victory in Europe rested with France. The Angevin Empire was indeed more impressive on the map than in reality. It was a motley, ill-knit collection of states, flung together by the chance of a single marriage and lacking unity both of purpose and strength. The only tie between England and her continental empire was the fact that Henry himself and some of his magnates held lands on either side of the Channel. There was no pretense of a single central government, no uniformity of administration or custom, no common interests or feelings of loyalty. Weak as Louis VII appeared in his struggle with the enterprising and active Henry, the tide of events flowed with a compact French monarchy, and even Louis left it more firmly established than he found it. The main method of the French was simple. Henry had inherited vast estates, but with them also all their local and feudal discontents. Louis could no longer set the Count of Anjou against the Duke of Normandy, but he could still encourage both in Anjou and in Normandy those local feuds and petty wars which sapped the strength of the feudal potentates, in principle, his vassals. Nor was the exploiting of family quarrels an unfruitful device. In the later years of his reign, the sons of Henry II, eager, turbulent and proud, allowed themselves to be used by Louis VII and his successor, the wily and gifted Philip Augustus, against their father. How, we may ask, did all this affect the daily life of England and her history? A series of personal feudal struggles fought in distant lands, the quarrels of an alien ruling class, were little understood and less liked by the common folk. Yet these things long burdened their pilgrimage. For many generations, their bravest and best were to fight and die by the marshes of the Loire or under the sun-baked hills of southern France in pursuit of the dream of English dominion over French soil. For this, 2 centuries later, Englishmen triumphed at Crecy, Poitiers, and Agincourt, or starved in the terrible Limoges March of the Black Prince. For this they turned fertile France into a desert, where even the most needed beasts died of thirst and hunger. Throughout the medieval history of England, war with France is the interminable and often the dominant theme. It groped and scraped into every reach of English life, moulding and fretting the shape of English society and institutions. No episode opens to us a wider window upon the politics of the 12th century in England than the quarrel of Henry II with his great subject and former friend, Thomas Becket, Archbishop of Canterbury. We have to realize the gravity of this conflict. The military state in feudal Christendom bowed to the church in things spiritual. It never accepted the idea of the transference of secular power to priestly authority. But the church, enriched continually by the bequests of hardy barons, anxious in the death agony about their life beyond the grave, became the greatest landlord and capitalist in the community. Rome used its ghostly arts upon the superstitions of almost all the actors in the drama. The power of the state was held in constant challenge by this potent interest. Questions of doctrine might well have been resolved, but how was the government of the country to be carried on under two conflicting powers, each possessed of immense claims upon limited national resources? This conflict was not confined to England. It was the root question of the European world as it then existed. Under William the Conqueror, schism had been avoided in England by tact and compromise. Under Lanfranc, the church worked with the crown, and each power reinforced the other against the turbulent barons or the oppressed commonalty. But now a great personality stood at the summit of the religious hierarchy, Thomas Becket, who'd been the king's friend. He'd been his chancellor, or, as Ranker first remarked, to use a somewhat equivalent expression, his most trusted cabinet minister. He had, in both home and foreign affairs, loyally served his master. He reorganized the imposition of scutage, a tax that allowed money to commute personal service in arms, and thus eventually pierced the feudal system to its core. He'd played his part in the acquisition of Brittany. The king felt sure that in Becket he had his own man, no mere servant, but a faithful comrade and a colleague in the common endeavour. It was by the king's direct influence and personal effort that Becket was elected archbishop. From that moment, all his gifts and impulses ran in another channel. Something like the transformation which carried Henry V from a rollicking prince to the august hero king overnight was now witnessed in Becket. His private life had always been both pious and correct. He had, of course, been immersed in political affairs. Nor was it as a somber figure behind the throne. But whereas hitherto, as a courtier and a prince, he'd rivaled all in magnificence and pomp, taking his part in the vivid pageant of the times, he now sought, by extreme austerities, to gather around himself the fame and honour of a saint. Becket pursued the same methods and ambitions in the ecclesiastical as previously he had done in the political sphere, and in both he excelled. He now championed the church against the crown in every aspect of their innumerable interleaving functions. He clothed this aggressive process with those universal ideas of the Catholic Church and the papal authority, which far transcended the bounds of our island, covering Europe and reaching out into the mysterious and the sublime. After a tour upon the continent and a conclave with the religious dignitaries of France and Italy, he returned to England imbued with the resolve to establish the independence of the church hierarchy of the state as represented by the king. Thus he opened the conflict which the wise Lanfranc had throughout his life striven to avoid. At this time, the mood in England was ripe for strife upon this issue. In a loose and undefined way, Saxon England had foreshadowed the theory to which the Elizabethan reformers long afterwards returned. Both thought of the monarch as appointed by God, not only to rule the state, but to protect and guide the church. In the 11th century, however, the papacy had been reinvigorated under Pope Gregory VII and his successors. Rome now began to make claims which were hardly compatible with the traditional notions of the mixed sovereignty of the king in all matters temporal and spiritual. The Gregorian movement held that the government of the church ought to be in the hands of the clergy, under the supervision of the pope. According to this view, the king was a mere layman, whose one religious function was obedience to the hierarchy. The church was a body apart, with its own allegiance and its own laws. By the reign of Henry II, the bishop was not only a spiritual officer, he was a great landowner, the secular equal of earls. He could put forces in the field. He could excommunicate his enemies, who might be the king's friends. Who, then, was to appoint the bishop? And when once appointed, to whom, if the Pope commanded one thing and the king another, did he owe his duty? If the king and his counsellors agreed upon a law contrary to the law of the Church, to which authority was obedience due? Thus there came about the great conflict between empire and papacy, symbolized in the question of investiture, of which the dispute between Henry II and Becket is the insular counterpart. The struggle between Henry II and Becket is confused by the technical details over which it was fought. There was, however, good reason why the quarrel should have been engaged upon incidents of administration rather than upon the main principles which were at stake. The Crown resented the claim of the Church to interfere in the state. But in the Middle Ages, no king dared to challenge the Church outright, or, much as he might hope to limit its influence, thought of a decisive breach. It was not till the 16th century that an English king, in conflict with the papacy, dared to repudiate the authority of Rome and nakedly declare the state supreme, even in spiritual matters. In the 12th century, the only practicable course was compromise. But the Church at this time was in no mood for a bargain. In every country, the secular power took up the challenge. But it was hard to meet, and in Central Europe at least, the struggle ended only in the exhaustion of both the Holy Roman Empire and the papacy. The Church in England, like the baronage, had gained greatly in power since the days of William the Conqueror and his faithful Archbishop Lanfranc. Stephen, in his straits, had made sweeping concessions to the Church, whose political influence then reached its zenith. These concessions, Henry felt, compromised his royal rights. He schemed to regain what had been lost, and as the first step in 1162, appointed his trusted servant Becket to be Archbishop of Canterbury, believing he would thus secure the acquiescence of the episcopacy. In fact, he provided the Church with a leader of unequalled vigour and obstinacy. He ignored, or missed, the ominous signs of the change in Becket's attitude, and proceeded to his second step, the publication in 1164 of the Constitutions of Clarendon. In these, Henry claimed, not without considerable truth, to be restating the customs of the kingdom as they'd been before the anarchy of Stephen's reign. He sought to retrace 30 years and to annul the effects of Stephen's surrender. But Becket resisted. He regarded Stephen's yieldings as irrevocable gains by the Church. He refused to let them lapse. Though he nominally accepted the Constitutions of Clarendon, he was soon at odds with the king over their application in his archdiocese. When, in October 1164, he was summoned to appear before the Great Council and explain his conduct, he haughtily denied the king's authority and placed himself under the protection of the Pope and of God. Thus he ruptured that unity which had hitherto been deemed vital in the English realm, and in fact declared war with ghostly weapons upon the king. Stiff in defiance, Becket took refuge on the continent, where the same conflict was already distracting both Germany and Italy. The whole thought of the ruling classes in England was shaken by this grievous dispute. It endured for 6 years, during which the Archbishop of Canterbury remained in his French exile. Only in 1170 was an apparent reconciliation brought about between him and the king at Fretval in Touraine. Each side appeared to waive its claims in principle. The king did not mention his rights and customs. The archbishop was not called upon to give an oath. He was promised a safe return and full possession of his see. King and primate met for the last time in the summer of 1170 at Chaumont. "My lord," said Thomas at the end, "my heart tells me that I part from you as one whom you shall see no more in this life." "Do you hold me as a traitor?" asked the king. "That be far from thee, my lord," replied the archbishop. But he returned to Canterbury, resolved to seek from the Pope unlimited powers of excommunication wherewith to discipline his ecclesiastical forces. The more potent and fierce the prince is, he wrote, the stronger stick and harder chain is needed to bind him and keep him in order. I go to England, he said, whether to peace or destruction, I know not, but God has decreed what fate awaits me. Meanwhile, in Becket's absence, Henry had resolved to secure the peaceful accession of his son, the young Henry, by having him crowned in his own lifetime. The ceremony had been performed by the Archbishop of York, assisted by six other bishops. This action was bitterly resented by Becket as an infringement of a cherished right of his see. After the Fretval agreement, Henry supposed that bygones were to be bygones. But Becket had other views. His welcome home after the years of exile was astonishing. At Canterbury, the monks received him as an angel of God. I am come to die among you, he said in his sermon. And again, in this church there are martyrs, and God will soon increase their number. He made a triumphal progress through London, scattering alms to the beseeching and exalted people. Then, hotfoot, he proceeded to renew his excommunication of the clergy who had taken part in the crowning of young Henry. These unfortunate priests and prelates travelled in a bunch to the king, who was in Normandy. They told a tale not only of an ecclesiastical challenge, but of an actual revolt and usurpation. They said that the archbishop was ready to tear the crown from the young king's head. Henry Plantagenet, first of all his line, with all the fire of his nature, received these tidings when surrounded by his knights and nobles. He was transported with passion. "What a pack of fools and cowards," he cried, "I have nourished in my house, that not one of them will avenge me of this turbulent priest." Another version says, "of this upstart clerk." A council was immediately summoned to devise measures for reasserting the royal authority. In the main, it shared the king's anger. Second thoughts prevailed. With all the stresses that existed in that fierce and ardent society, it was not possible that the realm could support a fearful conflict between the two sides of life represented by church and state. But meanwhile, another train of action was in process. Four knights had heard the king's bitter words spoken in the full circle. They travelled fast to the coast. They crossed the channel. They called for horses and rode to Canterbury. There, on December the 29th, 1170, they found the archbishop in the cathedral. The scene and the tragedy are famous. He confronted them with cross and mitre, fearless and resolute in warlike action, a master of the histrionic arts. After haggard parleys, they fell upon him, cut him down with their swords, and left him bleeding like Julius Caesar with a score of wounds to cry for vengeance. This tragedy was fatal to the king. The murder of one of the foremost of God's servants, like the breaking of a feudal oath, struck at the heart of the age. All England was filled with terror. They acclaimed the dead archbishop as a martyr, and immediately it appeared that his relics healed incurable diseases, and robes that he had worn, by their mere touch, relieved minor ailments. Here indeed was a crime, vast and inexpiable. When Henry heard the appalling news, he was prostrated with grief and fear. All the elaborate processes of law, which he had sought to set on foot against the rival power, was brushed aside by a brutal, bloody act. And though he'd never dreamed that such a deed would be done, there were his own hot words, spoken before so many witnesses, to fasten on him, for that age at least, the guilt of murder, and still worse, sacrilege. The immediately following years were spent in trying to recover what he'd lost by a great parade of atonement for his guilt. He made pilgrimages to the shrine of the murdered archbishop. He subjected himself to public penances. On several anniversaries, stripped to the waist and kneeling humbly, he submitted to be scourged by the triumphant monks. We may, however, suppose that the corporal chastisement, which apparently from the contemporary pictures was administered with birch rods, was mainly symbolic. Under this display of contrition and submission, the king laboured perseveringly to regain the rights of state. By the Compromise of Avranches in 1172, he made his peace with the papacy on comparatively easy terms. To many deep-delving historians, it seems that in fact, though not in form, he had by the end of his life re-established the main principles of the constitutions of Clarendon, which are, after all, in harmony with what the English nation, or any virile and rational race, would mean to have as their law. Certainly the papacy supported him in his troubles with his sons. The knights, it is affirmed, regained their salvation in the Holy Wars. But Becket's sombre sacrifice had not been in vain. Until the Reformation, the Church retained the system of ecclesiastical courts independent of the royal authority, and the right of appeal to Rome, two of the major points upon which Becket had defied the king. It is a proof of the quality of the age that these fierce contentions, shaking the souls of men, should have been so rigorously and yet so evenly fought out. In modern conflicts and revolutions in some great states, bishops and archbishops have been sent by droves to concentration camps, or pistoled in the nape of the neck in the well-warmed, brilliantly lighted corridor of a prison. What claim have we to vaunt a superior civilization to Henry II's times? We are sunk in a barbarism all the deeper because it's tolerated by moral lethargy and covered with a veneer of scientific conveniences. 18 years of life lay before the king after Becket's death. In a sense, they were years of glory. All Europe marvelled at the extent of Henry's domains, to which, in 1171, he'd added the lordship of Ireland. Through the marriages of his daughters, he was linked with the Norman King of Sicily, the King of Castile, and Henry the Lion of Saxony, who was a most powerful prince in Germany. Diplomatic agents spread his influence in the Lombard cities of northern Italy. Both emperor and pope invited him in the name of Christ and all Europe to lead a new crusade and to be king of Jerusalem. Indeed, after the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick Barbarossa, Henry stood next in Christendom. It was suspected by his contemporaries that his aim was to win for himself a kingdom in Italy, and even to wear the imperial crown. Yet Henry knew well that his splendour was personal in origin, tenuous and transient in quality. And he had also deep-clouding family sorrows. During these years he was confronted with no fewer than 4 rebellions by his sons. For the 3 eldest he provided glittering titles. Henry held Normandy, Maine and Anjou. Richard was given Aquitaine, and to Geoffrey went Brittany. These boys were typical sprigs of the Angevin stock. They wanted power as well as titles, and they bore their father no respect. Urged on by their mother, Queen Eleanor, who now lived in Poitiers apart from her husband, between 1173 and 1186 they rose in revolt in various combinations. On each occasion they could count on the active support of the watchful King of France. Henry treated his ungrateful children with generosity, but he had no illusions. The royal chamber at Westminster at this time was adorned with paintings done at the king's command. One represented 4 eaglets preying upon the parent bird, the 4th one poised at the parent's neck, ready to pick out the eyes. "The 4 eaglets," the king is reported to have said, "are my 4 sons, who cease not to persecute me even unto death. The youngest of them, whom I now embrace with so much affection, will sometime in the end insult me more grievously and more dangerously than any of the others." So it was to be. John, whom he'd striven to provide with an inheritance equal to that of his brothers, joined the final plot against him. In 1188, Richard, his eldest surviving son, after the death of the young Henry, was making war upon him in conjunction with King Philip of France. Already desperately ill, Henry was defeated at Le Mans and recoiled into Touraine. When he saw in the list of conspirators against him the name of his son John, upon whom his affection had strangely rested, he abandoned the struggle with life. "Let things go as they will," he gasped. "Shame. Shame on a conquered king." So saying, this hard, violent, brilliant, and lonely man expired at Chinon on July the 6th, 1189. The pious were taught to regard this melancholy end as the further chastisement of God upon the murderer of Thomas Becket. Such is the bitter taste of worldly power. Such are the correctives of glory. Chapter 5. The English Common Law. The Plantagenets were rough masters, and the temper of the age was violent. It was the violence, however, of vigour, not of decadence. England has had greater soldier kings and subtler diplomatists than Henry II, but no man has left a deeper mark upon our laws and institutions. His strange outbursts of frenzied energy did not exhaust themselves in politics, war, and the chase. Like his Norman predecessors and his sons, Henry II possessed an instinct for the problems of government and law, and it is here that his achievement lies. The names of his battles have vanished with their dust, but his fame will live with the English Constitution and the English Common Law. This great king was fortunate in his moment. William I and Henry I had brought to England, or preserved there, all those instruments through which their successor was to work. They themselves could move, but slowly and with caution. The land must settle itself to its new rules and rulers. In 1154, however, Henry of Anjou had come to a country which nearly 20 years of anarchy had prepared for the acceptance of a strong hand at the centre. Himself a Frenchman, the ruler of more than half France, he brought to his task the qualities of vision, wide experience, and a strength that did not scruple to stoop to cunning. The disasters of Stephen's reign determined Henry not only to curb baronial independence and regain the ground lost by his predecessor, but to go much further. In place of a multitude of manorial courts where local magnates dispensed justice, whose quality and character varied with the customs and temper of the neighbourhood, he planned a system of royal courts which would administer a law common to all England and all men. The policy was not without peril. The king was wise enough to avoid a direct assault, for he knew, as the conqueror had known, that to lay a finger upon the sanctity of customary rights would provoke disaster. Faced with this barrier, Henry shrewdly opposed custom to custom, and cloaked innovation in the respected garb of conservatism. He was careful to respect existing forms. His plan was to stretch old principles to take on new meanings. In an unwritten constitution, the limits of the king's traditional rights were vaguely defined. This opened a shrewd line of advance. For centuries before the conquest, church and king had been the enemies of seigneurial anarchy, but there'd been no question of swiftly extending the crown's jurisdiction. Fastening upon the elastic Saxon concept of the king's peace, Henry used it to draw all criminal cases into his courts. Every man had his own peace, which it was a crime to break, and the more important the man, the graver the breach. The king's peace was the most important of all, and those who broke it could be tried in the king's court. But the king's peace was limited, and often embraced only offences committed in the king's presence, or on the king's highway or land. When the king died, his peace died with him, and men might do as they willed. Cautiously and quietly, Henry began to claim that the king's peace extended over all England, and that no matter where it was broken, offenders should be tried in the king's courts. Civil cases he attracted by straining a different principle. The old right of the king's court to hear appeals in cases where justice had been refused, and to protect men in possession of their lands. He did not brandish what he was about. The changes that he made were introduced gradually and without legislation, so that at first they were hardly perceived. Rarely is it possible to state the date at which any innovation was made. Yet at the king's death, a clever man might have looked back and seen how much had been altered in the 35 years that Henry II had sat on the English throne. But if Henry was to pose as a conservative in the legal sphere, he must be consistent. Compulsion could play little part in his programme. It had to be the first principle of his policy to attract cases to his courts rather than to compel them. A bait was needed with which to draw litigants to the royal courts. The king must offer them better justice than they could have had at the hands of their lords. Henry accordingly threw open to litigants in the royal courts a new procedure for them, trial by jury. Regale quodam beneficium, a contemporary called it, a royal boon. And the description illuminates both the origin of the jury and the part it played in the triumph of the common law. Henry did not invent the jury. He put it to a new purpose. The idea of the jury is the one great contribution of the Franks to the English legal system, for, unknown in this country before the conquest, the germ of it lies far back in the practice of the Carolingian kings. In origin, the jury was a royal instrument of administrative convenience. The king had the right to summon a body of men to bear witness under oath about the truth of any question concerning the royal interest. It was through this early form of jury that William the Conqueror had determined the crown rights in the Great Domesday Survey. The genius of Henry II, perceiving new possibilities in such a procedure, turned to regular use in the courts an instrument which so far had only been used for administrative purposes. Only the king had the right to summon a jury. Henry, accordingly, did not grant it to private courts, but restricted it to those who sought justice before the royal judges. It was an astute move. Until this time, both civil and criminal cases had been decided through the oath, the ordeal, or the duel. The court would order one of the litigants to muster a body of men who would swear to the justice of his cause, and whom it was hoped God would punish if they swore falsely, or condemn him, under the supervision of a priest, to carry a red-hot iron, or eat a morsel of bread, or be plunged in a pool of water. If the iron did not burn, or the bread choke, or the water reject him, so that he could not sink, then divine providence was adjudged to have granted a visible sign that the victim was innocent. The duel, or trial by battle, was a Norman innovation based on the modern theory that the god of battles will strengthen the arm of the righteous, and was at one time much favoured for deciding disputes about land. Monasteries and other substantial landowners took the precaution, however, of assisting the Almighty by retaining professional champions to protect their property and their rights. All this left small room for debate on points of law. In a more rational age, men were beginning to distrust such antics, and indeed the Church refused to sanction the ordeal during the same year that Magna Carta was sealed. Thus, trial by a jury quickly gained favour. But the old processes were long in dying. If a defendant preferred to take his case before God, man could not forbid him, and the ordeal, therefore, was not abolished outright. Hence, a later age was to know the horrors of the peine forte et dure, the compulsion of the accused by slow pressure to death to agree to put himself before a jury. Time swept this away, yet so late as 1818 a litigant nonplussed the judges by an appeal to trial by battle, and compelled Parliament to abolish this ancient procedure. The jury of Henry II was not the jury that we know. There were various forms of it, but in all there was this essential difference. The jurymen were witnesses as well as judges of the facts. Good men and true were picked, not yet for their impartiality, but because they were the men most likely to know the truth. The modern jury, which knows nothing about the case till it is proved in court, was slow in coming. The process is obscure. A jury summoned to Westminster from different parts might be reluctant to come. The way was long, the roads unsafe, and perhaps only three or four would arrive. The court could not wait. An adjournment would be costly. To avoid delay and expense, the parties might agree to rely on a jury de circumstantibus, a jury of bystanders. The few jurors who knew the truth of the matter would tell their tale to the bystanders, and then the whole body would deliver their verdict. In time, the jurors with local knowledge would cease to be jurors at all and become witnesses, giving their evidence in open court to a jury entirely composed of bystanders. Such, we may guess, or something like it, was what happened. Very gradually, as the laws of evidence developed, the change came. By the 15th century, it was underway. Yet the old idea lingered, and as early as the Tudor kings, jurymen might be tried for perjury if they gave a wrongful verdict. The jury system has come to stand for all we mean by English justice, because so long as a case has to be scrutinized by 12 honest men, defendant and plaintiff alike have a safeguard from arbitrary perversion of the law. It is this which distinguishes the law administered in English courts from continental legal systems based on Roman law. Thus, amidst the great process of centralization, the old principle was preserved, and endures to this day, that law flows from the people and is not given by the king. These methods gave good justice. Trial by jury became popular. Professional judges, removed from local prejudice, whose outlook ranged above the interested or ignorant lord or his steward, armed with a king's power to summon juries, secured swifter decisions and a strong authority to enforce them. Henry, accordingly, had to build up, almost from nothing, a complete system of royal courts, capable of absorbing a great rush of new work. The instrument to which he turned was the Royal Council, the organ through which all manner of governmental business was already regularly carried out. It was to be the common parent of Chancery and Exchequer, of Parliament, of the common law courts, and those courts of prerogative on which the Tudors and Stuarts relied. At the outset of Henry II's reign, it dealt almost indiscriminately with every kind of administrative business. On the judicial side, the Court of the Exchequer, which tried cases affecting the royal revenue, was beginning to take shape. But in the main, the council in this aspect was scarcely more than the king's feudal court, where he did justice, like any other lord, among his vassals. Under Henry II, all this was changed. The functions of the king's justices became more and more specialized. During the reigns of his sons, the council began to divide into two great courts, the King's Bench and the Common Pleas. They did not become fully separate till a century later. Thereafter, with the Court of the Exchequer, they formed the backbone of the common law system down to the 19th century. In addition, travelling justices, justices in air, were from time to time appointed to hear all manner of business in the shires, whose courts were thus drawn into the orbit of royal justice. But all this was only a first step. Henry also had to provide means whereby the litigant, eager for royal justice, could remove his case out of the court of his lord into the king's court. The device which Henry used was the royal writ. At all costs, baronial rights must be formally respected. But by straining the traditional rights of the crown, it was possible to claim that particular types of case fell within the king's province. Upon this principle, Henry evolved a number of set formulae, or writs, each fitted to a certain type of case. And any man who could, by some fiction, fit his own case to the wording of one of the royal writs, might claim the king's justice. The wording of writs was rigid. But at this date, new forms of writ might still be given. For about 80 years, they increased in number, and with each new form, a fresh blow was struck at the feudal courts. It was not until de Montfort's revolt against the third Henry in the 13th century that the multiplication of writs was checked, and the number fixed at something under 200. This system then endured for 600 years. However the times might change, society had to adapt itself to that unbending framework. Inevitably, English law became weighted with archaisms and legal fictions. The whole course of a case might depend on the writ with which it was begun, for every writ had its special procedure, mode of trial, and eventual remedy. Thus the Saxon spirit of formalism survived. Henry II had only been able to break down the primitive methods of the early courts by fastening upon the law a procedure which became no less rigid. Yet, cumbersome though it was, the writ system gave to English law a conservative spirit which guarded and preserved its continuity from that time on in an unbroken line. It is a maxim of English law that legal memory begins with the accession of Richard I in 1189. The date was set for a technical reason, by a statute of Edward I. It could scarcely have been more appropriately chosen, however, for with the close of the reign of Henry II, we're on the threshold of a new epoch in the history of English law. With the establishment of a system of royal courts, giving the same justice all over the country, the old diversity of local law was rapidly broken down, and a law common to the whole land and to all men soon took its place. A modern lawyer, transported to the England of Henry's predecessor, would find himself in strange surroundings. With the system that Henry bequeathed to his son, he would feel almost at home. That is the measure of the great king's achievement. He'd laid the foundations of the English common law, upon which succeeding generations would build. Changes in the design would arise, but its main outlines were not to be altered. It was in these fateful and formative years that the English-speaking peoples began to devise methods of determining legal disputes, which survive in substance to this day. A man can only be accused of a civil or criminal offence which is clearly defined and known to the law. The judge is an umpire. He adjudicates on such evidence as the parties choose to produce. Witnesses must testify in public and on oath. They're examined and cross-examined not by the judge, but by the litigants themselves or their legally qualified and privately hired representatives. The truth of their testimony is weighed not by the judge, but by 12 good men and true, and it is only when this jury has determined the facts that the judge is empowered to impose sentence, punishment, or penalty according to law. All this might seem very obvious, even a platitude, until one contemplates the alternative system which still dominates a large portion of the world. Under Roman law and systems derived from it, a trial in those turbulent centuries, and in some countries even today, is often an inquisition. The judge makes his own investigation into the civil wrong or the public crime, and such investigation is largely uncontrolled. The suspect can be interrogated in private. He must answer all questions put to him. His right to be represented by a legal adviser is restricted. The witnesses against him can testify in secret and in his absence. And only when these processes have been accomplished is the accusation or charge against him formulated and published. Thus often arise secret intimidation, enforced confessions, torture, and blackmailed pleas of guilty. These sinister dangers were extinguished from the common law of England more than 6 centuries ago. By the time Henry II's great-grandson, Edward I, had died, English criminal and civil procedure had settled into a mould and tradition which in the mass govern the English-speaking peoples today. In all claims and disputes, whether they concerned the grazing lands of the Middle West, the oil fields of California, the sheep runs and gold mines of Australia, or the territorial rights of the Maoris, these rules have obtained, at any rate in theory, according to the procedure and mode of trial evolved by the English common law. Nor was this confined to how trials were conducted. The law that was applied to such multitudinous problems, some familiar, others novel, was in substance the common law of England. The law concerning murder, theft, the ownership of land, and the liberty of the individual was all transported, together with much else, to the New World, and, though often modified to suit the conditions and temper of the times, descends in unbroken line from that which governed the lives and fortunes of 12th-century Englishmen. Most of it was then unwritten, and in England much still remains so. The English statutes, for example, still contain no definition of the crime of murder, for this, like much other law, rested on the unwritten custom of the land as declared by the inhabitants, and interpreted, developed, and applied by the judges. Lawyers could only ascertain it by studying reports and records of ancient decisions. For this, they had already in this early age made their own arrangements. A century after Henry's death, they began to group themselves into professional communities in London, the Inns of Court, half colleges, half law schools, but predominantly secular, for the presence of clerics learned in the laws of Rome and the canon law of the Roman Church was not encouraged. And here they produced annual law reports, or yearbooks, as they were then called, whose authority was recognised by the judges, and which continued in almost unbroken succession for nearly three centuries. In all this time, however, only one man attempted a general and comprehensive statement of the English common law. About the year 1250, a judge of assize named Henry of Bracton produced a book of nearly 900 pages entitled A Tract on the Laws and Customs of England. Nothing like it was achieved for several hundred years, but Bracton's method set an example, since followed throughout the English-speaking world, not so much of stating the common law as of explaining and commenting on it, and thus encouraging and helping later lawyers and judges to develop and expand it. Digests and codes imposed in the Roman manner by an omnipotent state on a subject people were alien to the spirit and tradition of England. The law was already there in the customs of the land, and it was only a matter of discovering it by diligent study and comparison of recorded decisions in the earlier cases, and applying it to the particular dispute before the court. In the course of time, the common law changed. Lawyers of the reign of Henry II read into the statements of their predecessors of the 10th century meanings and principles which their authors never intended, and applied them to the novel conditions and problems of their own day. No matter. Here was a precedent. If a judge could be shown that a custom or something like it had been recognised and acted upon in an earlier and similar case, he would be more ready, if it accorded with his sense of what was just and with the current feelings of the community, to follow it in the dispute before him. This slow but continuous growth of what is popularly known as case law ultimately achieved much the same freedoms and rights for the individual as are enshrined in other countries by written instruments, such as the Declarations of the Rights of Man and the spacious and splendid provisions of the American Declaration of Independence and constitutional guarantees of civil rights. But English justice advanced very cautiously. Even the framers of Magna Carta did not attempt to lay down new law or proclaim any broad general principles. This was because both sovereign and subject were in practice bound by the common law, and the liberties of Englishmen rested not on any enactment of the state, but on immemorial, slow-growing custom, declared by juries of free men who gave their verdicts case by case in open court. Chapter 6. Coeur de Lion. The Christian kingdom, founded at Jerusalem after the First Crusade, had stood precariously for a century, guarded by the military orders of the Knights Templars and Hospitallers. Its continued existence was largely due to the disunity that prevailed among the Muslim lands surrounding it. At length, the rise of a great national leader of the Turks, or Saracens, united the Muslim power. In 1169, Saladin became vizier of Egypt. Shortly afterwards, he proclaimed himself Sultan. By origin, he was a Kurd, and by culture, a Damascene. Soon his power was stretching out into Syria, encircling the Crusaders' principalities on the Levantine coast. He took Damascus in 1174 and Aleppo in 1183. In their anxieties at these gathering dangers, the Christian community in Jerusalem and Guy of Lusignan, the king, offered the threatened crown first to Philip of France and then to Henry II, and made the West ring with cries for help. But the quarrels of the Western princes prevented effective measures being taken in time. In 1186, Saladin in his turn proclaimed a holy war. He promised his warlike hordes booty and adventure in this world, and bliss eternal in the next, and advanced upon Jerusalem. The Christian army of occupation, which took the field against him, perhaps 10,000 strong, was caught at a disadvantage in the thirsty desert and cut to pieces by greatly superior numbers at Hattin. The king, the grand master of the Templars, and many of the greatest nobles were taken prisoners. In October 1187, Jerusalem surrendered, and thereafter all Palestine and Syria, except Tyre, Antioch, and Tripoli, fell again into Muslim hands. The shock of these events resounded throughout Europe. The Pope shared the general horror of the Christian West. His legates traversed the courts, enjoining peace among Christians and war against the infidel. The sovereigns of the three greatest nations of the West responded to the call, and an intense movement stirred the chivalry of England, France, and Germany. Pictures were shown of the Holy Sepulchre defiled by the horses of the Saracen cavalry. Not only the gentlefolk, but to some extent all classes were swept by deep emotion. Not without sorrow, as the literature of those times shows, did many of the young crusaders leave home and loved ones for a journey into the dangers of the distant and the unknown. The magnetism of war and adventure, mingled with a deep counterpart of sacrifice and mysticism, lights the age and its efforts with the charm of true romance. In Germany, the Diet of Mainz solemnly swore the expedition to the Holy Land. The kings of France and England agreed upon a joint crusade, without, however, ceasing their immediate strife. To the religious appeal was added the spur of the tax gatherer. The Saladin tithe was levied upon all who did not take the cross. On the other hand, forgiveness of taxes and a stay in the payment of debts was granted to all crusaders. The strongest armies ever yet sent to the east were raised. Germany marshalled a large array round the standard of Frederick Barbarossa. A Scandinavian fleet bore 12,000 Norsemen through the Straits of Gibraltar. Thus did armoured Europe precipitate itself upon Asia. Meanwhile, the first of the rescuers, Conrad of Montferrat, who, hastening from Constantinople, had saved Tyre, was already besieging Acre. In the midst of these surgings, Henry II died in sorrow and disaster. He made no attempt to prescribe the succession, and it passed naturally to Richard. The new king affected little grief at the death of a father against whom he was in arms. He knelt beside his bier no longer than would have been necessary to recite the Lord's Prayer, and turned at once to the duties of his realm. In spite of many harsh qualities, men saw in him a magnanimity which has added luster to his military renown. At the outset of his reign, he gave an outstanding example. During his rebellion against his father, he'd pressed hard upon Henry II's rout at Le Mans, in the very forefront of the cavalry, without even wearing his mail. In the rearguard of the beaten army stood Henry's faithful warrior, William the Marshal. He confronted Richard and had him at his mercy. "Spare me," cried Richard in his disadvantage. So the marshal turned his